Okay, we want to, I'd like to welcome all of you to our meeting in the Committee of the Whole this afternoon. Those of you who were able to join us this morning for President Watkins' symposium on the on higher education and America's future, I think you'll agree that this morning was really exceptional. I found it to be one of the better events of its type that I've ever been to. So all of those who participated and made that happen, we thank them. We have a busy couple of days ahead of us with the inauguration and a lot of business to take care of, so we're going to launch right into it. But before we do, we'd like to welcome a couple of newcomers, I guess. First, we want to welcome Sanch Datta over here, who's a new regent, not officially yet because the legislature had to move the hearing back a little bit. So once that happens, we'll actually swear you in at our next meeting, but we're delighted to have you participating with us today, Sanch. And also we have President, there she is, Astrid Tumenez from Utah Valley University with us. And we welcome you your first week on the job, and she's still with us. she hasn't been scared away yet. So that's a good sign. This afternoon, we're going to focus on the Capitol facility requests from the institutions and the scoring of those. And that's in preparation for formal action on this in our meeting tomorrow. But we're going to turn the time over to Assistant Commissioner Rich Ammon to tell us how we're going to be proceeding here and give us some instruction. So, Rich.
Great. Thank you. So I'll provide some instructions as well as some introduction to the Capitol process. And I'll start out by outlining what our process is as we get into capital developments. And it's one of these processes that never ends, that once we start one, we start it again. And it starts in right after the legislative session, after we know what happens in the legislature. The Capitol Committee meets in April, and we solicit input along the way. And in April, the committee meets to decide what is the process that we want to look at for this coming year, as well as what are some guidelines for priorities for the regents. And they then take that to the May Board of Regents meeting, where you adopt guidelines. And I'll talk a little bit more about those guidelines in a minute, but those are what we'll have for you to score as a committee using those guidelines that were adopted back in May. So this is the culmination of a long process. And wanted to point out that in July, the institutions submit their requests, both to us and the State Building Board, and these requests can reflect the guidelines that were adopted in May and can also include needs from the institution. In August, just a few weeks ago, the committee met, the Capitol Committee, and they toured all 8 institutions in a 2-day whirlwind tour. And they met and discussed these priorities. And then I put together the quantitative side of the scoring process based on data that was presented from the institutions and collected by our office as far as enrollments and institutional space capacity. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute as well. And so today is this culmination. It's the qualitative side. So whereas that part was more quantitative, it has data to back it up, this is a little more qualitative, in which we'll have two parts, your scoring of the guidelines, and then the Capitol Committee will have some discretionary points to go through. Before I get to the scoring, just wanted to highlight in tab A of your diligent board, there's information on all of these projects. There's a little blurb about them, the cost, the square feet, and then some charts that show academic space per FTE, as well as total space per FTE, just some across-the-board comparisons, recognizing that each institution has a different mission, and so some of those square feet will be realized because of those missions. And the last piece I wanted to mention as kind of an introduction is the utilization. We talked about this in January and then in March. There is a policy, and I quote the policy up here, that the idea is to incorporate utilization into this process. But again, because we start out back in April of setting aside this this process, it was determined at that point not to include utilization as it's a very recent kind of requirement on the institutions, but we fully intend to incorporate it next year, and that we will have institutions provide a new round of data in December, which we can then bring to the January Board of Regents meeting, as well as an institutional report, because numbers are always they need some qualitative aspects, I think, to explain them. And so we'll have reports from each of the institutions explaining their utilization, what they're doing on the campuses, hopefully put that into context. This slide, wanted to highlight that the legislature has been good to higher education. So over the last three or so sessions, the legislature has essentially funded at least one major project at each of our institutions. Some of those have just been completed. You can see Snow College, Salt Lake Community College, SUU. Those projects just barely recently completed. Utah Valley, the Utah State Biology Building, and then the Weber State Building are a month or two out. They'll be completed really soon here. And then there's a couple others, the Biological Natural Resources, Dixie Human Performance, the U of U. They're a little further out, but they're underway and in construction. So those are some of the big projects that have happened through this cycle, this funding cycle. And the last kind of informational slide I have is something that the Capitol Committee had asked for, that to talk about. We talk a lot about the state investment, but what are other investments that we have in our higher educational facilities? And so I pulled this together to show over the last 10 years, the legislature has been very generous with tax money that's funded about $750 million in our higher education campuses. At that same time, we've put in almost $2 billion. And that includes, there's a lot of that that includes hospital revenue for hospital facilities, but also student dorms, student centers, and a significant amount of donations. So it essentially, it's for every dollar of state money, institutions have found $2.60 of outside funds. And so I think that's helpful to put in context, that there's a lot of other construction projects going on, a lot of money going into these projects as well. And this slide shows that this is recently updated as of yesterday. So this year, we didn't want to be surprised in the legislative session by cost changes. And so it's a partnership between ourselves and the state construction office, who helps put together cost estimates on our projects. And this year we asked that we have the same numbers going into our meeting as the building board will have that goes to the legislature and the governor's office. And so these numbers have slightly changed from the numbers that are in your packet because they were updated yesterday, but these will be final so that they won't change in 3 months from now, which is been somewhat of an issue in the past. And you can see, for the most part, institutional projects are costing a little bit more. We're in an inflationary environment that it's positive. There's a lot of construction going on, but it's costing a little bit more. And from what I have heard, that some contractors are maybe using the tariffs as a way to increase some of their costs. But regardless, that it's a little higher increases. And the one I would point out is Dixie, is that there's actually decreased, but it's a little misconceived, because their project was more like $52-53 million last year. It had jumped up to 59 in the initial estimate, and that the state office backed it down. So it's still, it's inflated from where it was last year. It just looks like it's going down. With that, I'll just really quickly go over the point scores. The quantitative side that I put together is highlighted here in orange. There's really four categories where we score points for these projects. The first is in need, and need analysis based on an inventory. So what square feet institutions currently have, and then what we do is we use five-year projections on their enrollment to see where, what will they need in the future. And they get points for the ability of their project to capture that gap, the gap between where they're at and where they need to be based on enrollments. The other funds are points that are generated for bringing other partnerships or other donations to the table. It does not include student fees, does not include institutional revenue, but it does include partnerships, and it gives community colleges more of an advantage than the research institutions, recognizing there's a little bit of a gap between ability to raise funds, and so it gives a little bit of weight to those priorities. And then facility condition, there are points available for projects that replace or remodel an existing facility that has deficiencies in structure, electrical, seismic, life safety, those kinds of issues. And then finally, institutional priority is kind of a gimme. It was meant to be for if institutions brought more than one project to the table, it would score the second project lower. In this case, there's eight institutions, eight projects, so they all received the 25 points. What will be important is these last 25 points, the columns that are blank. And that's what today is about, and what we'll ask for your help as the Board of Regents, that there's two categories. There's the criteria points and then the discretionary points. The discretionary points are what the Capital Committee will meet immediately following this committee to discuss the needs, discuss the presentations, as well as what they saw in their tours, and assign up to 15 points. The criteria points are what should be on your table before you. There's three pages that have scores for the Board of Regents to score. Sorry, I didn't give one to the presidents, that for probably obvious reasons. But there's four categories. These are the categories that were adopted back in May. These are the guidelines, and they mirror the strategic objectives of the Board of Regents. So that's completion, capacity, affordability, and workforce. And so as you listen to these presentations, we've asked institutions to talk about how their project fit into those categories, and to ask you to give your input on what you hear, your qualitative assessment of those areas, and to either give them full points, half points, or no points for each of those areas. And just to highlight, the capacity is the largest area here. It's worth 4 points, the others are worth 2. And that the idea would be that at the end of this meeting, I'll collect them. They'll be anonymous, unless you want to put your name on it, but we'll collect them anonymously, and then I'll average them. And I'll take that information back with me to the Capital Committee, who will then allocate those points as well as the discretionary points at our afternoon meeting. So with that concludes this part of the presentation. I do have a few instructions for presenters, but are there any questions from the board for what we anticipate doing today?
Just clear on the half points. is the answer 0 or 1, or do you want a 0.5, or how would you, just for consistency's sake?
So there should be a box on your sheet, and so if you just check the box, that it'll be, so for the 3 it'd be 1 point, or for capacity it would be 2 points. But yeah, if you just check the box, I think that's sufficient, unless you'd like to write it out as fine as
so
well.
So if you check, maybe it's just, I may be the only one confused, but on capacity, to take as an example, you've got 4 points possible.
Correct. Half points would be 2.
Okay, so it's going to be 4, 2, or 0.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Whereas the rest would be 2, 1, or 0.
Yeah, so you can't put in a 3 and then a 0.5 or anything like that.
Right. I guess we'll take write-ins if we ever get into election season, so if you'd like to write it in.
Okay. It's all about reconciliation here. Okay. Any other instructions, Rich?
So just really quickly for the presenters, we've allocated 15 minutes between presentations, but 10 minutes for the presenters and presentations. And so I will have 3 different slides. I'll give you time and 1 and 5 minutes so you can gauge where you're at. And then would ask that when it becomes time that you close quickly so we can keep reasonably on track. And then we'll have 5 minutes open for questions in between. And again, I'll give you the 1 minute heads up and time as well, that when time comes, even though there's probably a lot of questions, if we can close as quickly as possible, we'll stay on track. And so I'll be in the back right behind Regent Barnes I'll be signaling in the back.
Well, yeah, we don't have a box for punctuality, but that may be the no points thing.
That's right. That's right. Oh, and for the presenters, I will say that there is a clicker if you would like to use it, and that I have your presentation pulled up here, that if you just close out, when you're done, just click the red circle at the Mac, so the red X on the left side, it'll close it and it'll go to the next presentation for the next person.
Yes.
I just have a couple questions, sorry.
Yeah, you bet.
My first one was on utilization. I thought one of the best discussions we've had since I've been a regent, it's only been about a year, was on space utilization. I know there's differing opinions, and I appreciate that. I know it's a complicated thing. How exactly are we going to use space utilization in the future? Do we know how that's going to be a part of the formula, or just that it's going to be?
Yes and no. So, yes. It will be, and I think it's up for discussion. We have some ideas. But I think we'll be soliciting feedback from institutions so that we're all on the same page. And that's part of this process, that we recognize that there are going to be institutions that aren't happy with each part of the process, right? But the idea is that we settle on the process. And so the idea being, and Kimberly can jump in as well, we've thought of how we use its classroom and laboratory usage as we look at how well those are being used. And we've set some preliminary benchmarks, and that we'll probably use those going forward as kind of a standard to look at.
So one of the things that we started doing in the standing committees, and now that we have the standing committees back, I've implemented a discussion section specifically for finance and facilities. So for example, this meeting, you'll see that we're talking about the tuition study update and a policy related to the non-capital assets. We will bring forward a discussion item about how utilization will be be incorporated, because we need to have your feedback in this process as well. And so the institutions will have an opportunity to see examples and opportunity to comment, but the board itself, the finance facilities, we will bring that back to you, and you can say, we agree, we disagree, we want you to do this, and then we'll build it into it. And then in April, when it comes time to setting the ground rules for the CDP, we will have a better sense of how it will be absolutely incorporated into it.
So we'll have plenty of time to look at that and evaluate it. It will just be brought to us for a vote. We're going to have some vetting, some discussion on how to end the presidents, and we're going to be able to collaborate on that a little bit.
Correct.
Okay. My other question, you had a slide with square footage on it.
Yeah.
But I didn't really understand what that was. Do you mind just
explaining
that? Yeah, you bet. I missed that.
And it's also in your packet in tab A, if you wanted to look at that. If this is hard to see, but
had dollar signs, I think it shouldn't have had. That may have been confusing a little bit.
First one, but then it looked like it was a currency amount, and I didn't know.
Is that right?
It's a different slide.
Go to the total. It's
chart.
No,
it's right there.
No,
it's changed. There it is, right there.
It's that one.
There shouldn't be dollars.
So is that designed to be, that's a square footage amount, right?
So there's two, oh, yeah, you're right. That second column, that's a great catch. That second column, those are square feet. So this is, yeah, those are the square feet of that facility. So like the U's, looking at a 140,000 square foot facility. And yeah, sorry about that. Those are dollar signs. They should just be
One more.
I just wanted to make sure I was clear.
No.
My last question is one, and maybe you can answer this, maybe you can't, but you said something that I thought was interesting. There's eight requests and there's eight institutions.
Correct.
And you said the score, the 25, was equal because they all only requested one.
Yes.
Are we putting the institutions in a position where they're only asking for one so they don't disadvantage themselves? Because it's possible that one institution could use one or more facilities and another institution could use zero, right?
That's right. And so
are we incenting them to request only one when there could be institutions that need more?
With respect to the way that the institutions, each of the institutions has a five-year capital master planning process. In terms of the evaluation process, mm-hmm. It's in the policy that all institutions advance one for the region's consideration. Ultimately, otherwise we could go and have you rank everybody's five-year plans, but how many are we actually going to forward to the legislature with respect to funding? And so historically, the policy did allow for the research institutions to do two. The committee last year said we want to move away from that because in reality the University of Utah isn't going to get two buildings from the legislature every single year, or Utah State isn't going to get two buildings. And so it's just every institution, we rank the top one for them. But if you do want to see a five-year plan where the institutions say here are the next, here are the buildings in line, that exists. And usually we get a sense of that with a master plan, but we can do something in a more comprehensive way where you can start to see institutions, here's what their proposed building plan is. There's also a broader conversation that we're going to bring to you as well with respect to statewide master planning in terms of how do we select locations in terms of where to build, not necessarily based at the institution level, but the idea of where the population centers are and what does that look like, and should we have locations to serve population centers one way or another. So
I would just, my last comment, Mr. Chair, is just I would like to see a longer plan because this appears to me like everybody's only bringing one, so everybody can get their piece of this proverbial pie, and I'm not really interested in that as a region. I'm more interested in what does the system need collectively to succeed, and some institutions may need more, and it may not look fair to another institution, but we're supposed to be serving the students and the taxpayers and making sure that we have a long-term plan. And I'm not saying that we didn't do that here. I appreciate the work and everything that's gone into this, but when I hear there's eight requests and there's eight universities and they all score the same, what concerns me is that we're gaming the system for a score and not looking at what's best for higher education in Utah. So I would just respectfully request that we look at that and make sure we're not doing that and not incenting the institutions to do that. Because I would bet that, I mean, I don't know, but I would bet that that's probably what's going on and that's not what's best for the system. So that's it.
I appreciate that. And I think there's certainly opportunity to discuss that further in the Finance Committee. And I just underscore what, you know, as we go through this process today and tomorrow, just to reiterate, I mean, we shouldn't be having institutional favorites. I mean, this is really about a system and what we need to do, you know, what the highest priorities are for the system, and we should all keep that in mind as we're scoring these. The other thing before we, and then we'll launch into these presentations, I want to really thank Regent Clyde and the Capital Facilities Committee for the time they spent to go around and do a lot of homework, and Regent Clyde facilitating the logistics of that made it possible to do that in a couple of days. We really appreciate that contribution. I think with that we'll go ahead and get started, and I'm just a few minutes behind, but if we can now try to keep to the schedule, and we're going to start with Utah State University and Vice President Dave Cowley.
Thank you.
While he's walking up, the commissioner tells me this is a random drawing that established the order, by the way.
Are you sure?
Okay, my name is Dave Cowley. I'm the Administrative Vice President at Utah State University.
It's an honor for me to be able to present to you our capital development request, which is a Center for Languages and Cultures. The project is for our College of Humanities and Social Sciences. This is a large college. It provides a lot of the general education to all of Utah State University. They are the most fragmented college that we have from the standpoint of where all their space exists and their faculty are and so on. So this project seeks to do three things. Number one, try and consolidate the departments and programs within that college into buildings that are close or adjacent to each other, and provide departments with space that is functionally adequate for their programs. This is a big problem with the space that I'll talk about today, is even where they have space, some of the things they're doing, there's either just simply not enough of that space, or they're in space that is very inadequate to be carrying on the activities that they have in those programs. And then to increase the amount of space in order to address growing programs. The languages program is one of the fastest growing programs that we have. In fact, it is the fastest growing program within the college. And so I'll talk just a little bit about that as well. The project consists of a new building that's approximately 60,000 gross square feet, and it will be sited between Old Main and Ray B. West, which is the English building. So if you do happen to be familiar with our campus, you'll see on the next slide that there is the quad, and the building to the left is Old Main, and the new building is in a dark shaded gray right next to the building that is our English building that's called Ray B. West. Ray B. West is a very old, very historic building, as are all of the buildings around the quad, or at least most of the buildings around the quad. And it needs some help as well, but that's not part of this particular project, but it is a project that will fit in that, once again, if we have the new space and are able to expand and change some of the space assignments for the faculty within the college, it gives us an opportunity to come back and look at the renovation needs of Ray B. West in a future project. So again, the project will be the home for the languages, philosophy, and communication studies. Again, as I said before, the growth in the languages program is pretty high. We have just introduced a new major of Portuguese, and we're also expanding the faculty for our Chinese programs. And there are some plans in the future to add a couple of additional languages, one of which is Arabic. And again, those the languages and the amount of faculty are really just responding to the desires of the students for their language skills, in addition to whatever degrees they're studying. As you might imagine, many students do get degrees, master's degrees or bachelor's degrees in a language, but it's more common that students are actually majoring in another discipline, but they're adding the language skills. And the communication studies also is both communication and journalism is part of that. The sociology, social work, and anthropology, that department, that's a long name for the department, but that department will also be in the new building. Anthropology in particular is really made up of two different pieces. It's a physical anthropology, which you might think of more as archaeology, and a cultural anthropology, which is really about cultures and understanding and appreciating different cultures. The Anthropology Museum is a museum that currently exists inside of Old Main. It's very inadequate in the amount of space. It's a really nice museum, but it's just inadequate in the amount of space for the items that inadequate for the curation of all of the items, but it's also inadequate for the student opportunities to be participating in museum curation or some of the research projects and so on that go along with the museum. And yet there's a large demand and a very growing demand for the museum studies certificate that is accomplished through that museum. And then Utah Public Radio, which exists currently now in a temporary 1941 Quonset hut that is still on our campus today. It's really awful space, and there and And so they would be relocated into this new building so that we can take that Quonset hut down. So the need, again, this particular college has not received any significant additional space in the last 15 years, but they are a growing college. Their programs are, they do have some space in Old Main and in Raby West, and remember that those are the bookends for this new building, but they are also in the oldest part of the Veterinary Sciences Building, which is a very, very tiny and cramped space for them, and then the Quonset hut, as I said, which is called the Multimedia and Distance Learning, but also in the Geology and in our Conference Center, which really, those buildings have nothing to do with these programs, but they've had to stick faculty and other people there. So the Department of Languages, as I said, is fast growing. The museum has had a lot of additional interest in those museum study certificates, and UPR is just in a really limited amount of space. So if I could just for a moment, you know, some of the ways that we intend to advantage our students with this project, one of the ways that students are really retained is when they have the opportunity for mentorship from faculty. And it's a little hard for students to have to be going to all these different buildings to find their faculty. That's something we'd like to correct with the idea of consolidation. But also the space for anthropology in this old Vet Sciences Building, which is just really a horrible part of the building. It's almost 100 years old. We have very limited space, which means that there's only a few graduate students that even get to participate in the hands-on part of the research with the archaeology pieces of anthropology, and there's absolutely no space to accommodate any undergraduate students, even though that's a high demand and a high need. So we know that with that faculty mentorship, we can help retain students and help them complete on time. Same thing with the museum. There's just not enough space to be able to have the number of students who would like to have undergraduate and graduate research opportunities in that museum. And almost the entire collection in the museum is donated to USU. And we continue to receive donations as Utah grows and developers dig up sites. There's always more things that they need to put into museums. And that's one of the ways that we help the state as well. And with UPR, the Utah Public Radio, that's part of National Public Radio. It serves the entire state of Utah. And the internship opportunities there are very limited, and yet they're in high demand. And they're in high demand because they're important for the jobs in the workplace, for them to have actual hands-on experiences in studios and programming and so on. The capacity issues are really important here. As I've talked about, each one of these programs that I've mentioned, they're just cramped on space. We've got faculty sharing offices and different things like that, which is not always the best situation. And we're trying to just add space for growing programs. But really, if you were on the tour, you already have appreciation for this. If you weren't, please ask your fellow regents about this. But the Quonset hut is just kind of a ridiculous space for us to have this many years later. It's just a horrible space to try and have any kind of functionality. And that Vet Sciences space as well. If you walk around long enough, you'll end up on about 5 or 6 or 7 different levels of flooring because it's really just kind of a rabbit warren type of space. So the capacity of all these programs is very important. And as the governor has said and other Utah leaders, businesses are really looking for students that have not only language skills, but cultural skills, because we're competing in a global marketplace, and these are very important skills for people to have. Not only the majors in these areas, but so many other, you might be a business major, you might be in natural resources, it doesn't really matter. The ability to understand and be sensitive to cultures and perhaps speak a language or two are very important qualifications for us to be competing in a global marketplace. As far as the cost, you've already seen the numbers that Rich put up. It's a $24 million project, about 60,000 square feet of space. The increase in state-funded O&M is around $500,000, and remember that there is some space that's being demolished, and so the actual O&M for the new building would be slightly less than that, but then we would give back the piece that is for the old building. And that is the formal part of the presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have about our project.
Radio tends to be less popular, and the population of people who listens to radio tends to be aging. according to statistics, what is the need for public radio on a university campus?
So as I said, it's part of the national public radio system. It's actually very listened to in rural Utah. In fact, that's essentially where you'll find the programming is throughout Utah. There's a public radio, you know, right there in Salt Lake from the University of Utah, but we essentially serve the rest of the state. So not only does it serve the citizens of the state, there is pretty good listenership, but it also is as I said, hands-on opportunities for our students to be involved in running the radio station or programming content. The internships there in communications and journalism majors is actually very high. So it's not only for the students that are achieving degrees, but there actually is good listenership around rural Utah.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dave, we appreciate that. Next up is, we have Steve Hood from Snow College representing President Carlston.
All right, somebody put a Mac up here instead of a real PC. I don't know how to close the window.
Red dot. Left top corner.
Left top corner, red dot.
Red. Yep.
All right. I'm going to out. Thomas just confessed he actually listens to NPR, so.
He's one of those old guys. I'll get you back. I'll out you on what you said.
As long as it's a car
talk. Good afternoon. Thanks very much for inviting us to come forward here. We're honored to be here, and we're grateful to the Regents and all the support that they've given Snow College in the past, and currently all the great support they've given. We're grateful also to our sister institutions and the great relationship we have with them. We have been very proud of the growth at Snow College, but not only the growth, the completion rates that we enjoy at the college. We were recently at a conference on the East Coast, and we were invited there to and asked why is it that you have such a high graduate transfer completion rate? And so we went through that, and they said, well, you'll never get any higher than that. But the truth is that we have to get higher than that, and we have to do some things to try to make provide opportunities for our students to be able to transfer at an even higher rate and to be able to graduate in a more timely fashion. One of the areas that we struggle with in particular is in social science. It is a field of study that, or a division within our campus that is probably has more challenges that face it than some of the others, and there's a number of reasons that I'll go over in this. But we believe that we're going to need a space for 1,300 more students by the year 2025. It's not a whole lot of students compared to some of our sister institutions that have such large populations. But it's large for a campus that has about 4,000 students on it right now in Ephraim. So we're really looking at a way that we can accommodate this growth as it continues to occur. We have a campus master plan that was approved by the Regents some time ago, and we're growing, we're greatly restricted in the space in city center in the great metropolis of Ephraim. We're closed in, and so in order to look at this, we realize that we're going to have to take out existing buildings and existing facilities that aren't up to date in order to facilitate the things that we do need to do. And what is it that we need to do? Well, we're very interested in trying to meet some goals that match not just with our master plan, but with our college mission. We realize that every single institution has to teach general education. We consider that not a bad thing. That's a good thing. And we know that every institution focuses on how they teach general education, how they teach social sciences, and that there's differences in how they do it. But for a small college like Snow College, it has to be different. We have to have different focal points. Our bread and butter really is general education and these introductory courses at the first and second year that help prepare students as they go on. And there's some certain challenges that we're facing here that we haven't been able to come up with satisfactory solutions. One of them is that we don't have suitable lab spaces in the social sciences to teach quantitative methodology courses at a level that we want to. We need to find a new space to be able to set up new laboratories. Our current social science computer laboratory consists of just a room that has five computers up against a wall. And while it works for very few students, but it has become a problem when it comes to trying to transfer students to make sure that we've prepared them properly. At the same time, we're adopting a new general education program that starts a year from now, and every student will be required to have a high-impact course that's team-taught by three different professors. We're struggling a little bit now because we're running this as a pilot, and we need different kinds of teaching spaces in order to reconfigure classroom space. Our new science building has been a real help in this regard because we can reconfigure seating, we can reconfigure the way that we set up labs, all sorts of different things to be able to meet the needs of this demand for this new course. Currently, in any given semester, we have about 42% to 46% of our students that are engaged or enrolled in a social science course at any time. The particular challenges with this is that we have far fewer professors per department in the social sciences than we do in any other areas. We're trying to grow them. We've added three professors this year to the social sciences, but there's less facility to have them. They're spread out all over the EFRM campus, and it's very difficult to try to keep these programs together because we have offices that are in different buildings and so on. So there's only one department in all of the social sciences that is housed in a single building. All the rest of them are spread out over the campus. And so this makes it very difficult to grow our programs. We've run out of classroom space, and we've run out of faculty space to try to accommodate them. As we've worked with these particular two problems that we have, inadequate social science space and a greater need for general education space, we realize that there's certain things that we need to do, and we need to plan according for the future. Because the new GE program will be team taught, we've thought in the terms of how to set up classrooms, lab space, different experimental spaces that can focus on helping to teach students and engage them in critical thinking, collaboration, problem solving, and so we need these different kinds of flexible spaces. At the same time, we need a space for a new collaborative partnership that we're developing with Utah State University, a 2+2 program, to where we can bring Utah State professors right into our building to help with the new education program, to where students can stay at Snow College, get a four-year degree in elementary ed, secondary ed, or special education, and stay in our six-county service area where there's an acute shortage of teachers. In terms of the actual space that we have now, our Family Life building only has four classrooms in it, yet it's teaching 27 sections a week. Our Social Science building has five classrooms in it, and they're teaching 43 sections a week in that building. As I mentioned, we have faculty in five different buildings, and there's only one adjunct office. All the rest of the adjunct faculty go to the library and set up shop during office hours in some student study areas. One of our biggest concerns, though, continues to be for the social science program, how to graduate and transfer students in a timely fashion. In order to get students to graduate seamlessly, they really need these methodology courses. We have set up some methodology in the library computer lab But it is not a space that's really teachable. It's actually a larger space than this is. It has students that are in that laboratory all the time that are there also just to study and not necessarily for a individual class, and so it makes it extremely difficult. We would have to remove two buildings, as I mentioned. One is the Family Life Building there in the upper left. It's an old LDS Institute of Religion building that was given to the college. And Greenwood Hall, which we hate to get rid of. It's a gorgeous building on the outside, but it has facility problems on the inside that are very difficult. And then we have a social science building that we do want to keep. It's built like a fortress. It's over 100 years old now, but we do want to repurpose this building for mathematics. The Family Life Building has some particular problems that we're worried about. We've been able to put a temporary fix to the subfloors and so on, but we'll have other things that we need. But our biggest problems are, for example, in our nutrition classes, we only have 3 stations to accommodate 24 students in a class. So that means that each station has to accommodate 8 students. For our clothing and textile classes, we can only accommodate 11 students at a time. Our preschool has 21 students by state limitations. We would like to increase that to 40. This is a shot of some of the right-hand side is our nutritional laboratories. As I mentioned, we want to take this social science building then and repurpose it for mathematics. There's no way it will handle all of the mathematics courses. We will continue to teach mathematics all over. But what it will do is help reduce some of the classroom need overall. So we're excited about the prospects of someday having this building and having new laboratories that we can have for teaching methodology, for our criminal justice classes, new geography facilities, new food and science and nutrition courses, and being able to accommodate our new new general education courses. So I'd be happy to entertain any questions or concerns that you might have.
Questions from any regents?
Any situations and how I might bribe you? Anything at all? Yes, sir. I think there was a hand over here.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Maybe you can answer this, maybe not. I was just looking at the total square footage in the chart that was provided to us, and snow is right up there, you know, total number of square feet right up there with the University of Utah more than any. Just curious, and just as a side note before I ask my question, I think that's why space utilization is so important. There could be a lot of square footage not being used. It could be functionally obsolete. It could be outdated, whatever. But we don't know that as regions because we don't have utilization. So that's why I asked earlier about using that in our scoring but do you want to address that? Because I
wanted
to say you got a lot of square footage for comparatively. And
thanks very much. I appreciate the question actually, because I saw that I wish that hadn't have been on there, to tell you the truth. Where the real difference comes in is in the differences between the square footage that exists on the Ephraim campus and the Richfield campus. The Richfield campus has, frankly, a lot of space. We have a lot of room to grow there still. The Ephraim campus is not nearly as much. We have at any one time in the afternoon in the Washburn building on the Richfield campus, we may have half the classrooms that don't have a single class going on in them. Whereas in the Ephraim campus, we're evenly distributed. We have as many sections in the morning occurring as we do in the afternoon. And so it's a lot more crowded situation there. We wish we had some of the classroom space that Richfield has. We just brought in a whole new wing of classrooms that was turned over to us from the Richfield, from the Sevier School District, and that gave us so much more classroom space. And we wish we would have had those 8 classrooms in Ephraim.
Okay, any other questions?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Appreciate
thank you very
time.
Much for the presentation. Okay, President Williams from Dixie.
Well, good afternoon. It's great to be here with you. I almost went to Logan today because we usually have this at the Logan campus. I actually had to circle back around and come to the U of U. But I'm excited to provide you a brief overview of our project. Dix State University, we are proposing a 120,000 square foot multi-story science, engineering, and technology building. This is the second year that we've made this request. The scope of the project has not changed in that we have the same amount of square footage, but as Rich had said, that it is now a $57.9 million project because of the escalation. We were fortunate last year that the state legislature gave us a little bit of money, so we have programmed this building and we're moving into design. And by the end of the legislative session, if we were to receive funding, we will be shovel ready. This building is part of our campus master plan. It will be built between the Eccles and the Math, Snow, and Science building. And I thought I'd focus most of my time on the Regent criteria. I'll address the completion, capacity, affordability, and workforce. With regards to completion, as you know, Dixie State University has been growing very fast. The last 2 years, percentage-wise, we've been the fastest growing institution. This year, third week numbers are not out, but we have grown again this year. With that growth, there's been a tremendous strain on our campus, primarily in the STEM areas. Looking at our STEM areas, over the past 5 years, our physiology course and our lab enrollments have increased 53% and 66%. As last year, our anatomy labs keep going to capacity. We teach those 14 hours a day, 6 hours or 6 days a week. When the subcommittee came to our campus, they got to meet Dr. Erin O'Brien. She is our chair of our biology department. And this year in sections in the bottleneck classes, they doubled capacity to see if they would fill. They all filled and had waiting lists. Unfortunately, we had to cancel some of those sections because we couldn't find qualified professors. Erin is someone that I avoid on campus now because I hear the same story every time I need more space. Our laboratories are definitely too small, as I'll show some pictures to you here in a few moments, but they definitely don't adequately accommodate the sizes of classes that we want. We want to focus, instead of 12 to 14 students in those laboratories, we want 24 to 32 so we can more efficiently utilize the space. This new building allows us to triple the number of sections of laboratories in the space. Through programming, our faculty have been very innovative. We had a lab expert come in, and instead of having a chemistry lab and a physiology lab where that's all it's used for, there are going to be flexible spaces so that they have combined workspace and storage space so that the labs can be transformed to anything that they would like to use. Our biology department and chemistry enrollments have exploded over the last 5 years. And our first cohort for mechanical engineering this fall, we are hoping 25 to 30. We have 159 students enrolled in our mechanical engineering program. We've also focused our academic plan on the STEM areas. As you know, there's a great demand for workforce in this area in southern Utah. These are some of the programs that we've added. We have two master's degree programs that will be approved this year. We have focused a lot on getting the students prepared from K through 12. We have shared this presentation many times, but Dixie State has been involved in the K through 12 STEM pipeline. We have been nationally recognized, and I was honored to be invited. Actually, wasn't invited. Our campus was invited to Apple headquarters, and I kind of weaseled my way in so I can go see their new headquarters. But through the Code Camps, the eSmart, the Girls Go Digital, we have seen double and triple the numbers of students wanting to get into these programs. So the completion, we have great concern because we know that students are not going to be able to complete if they have a healthcare or STEM and tech program in a timely manner because they can't get the classes that we can offer them. And that leads to our capacity. Dixie State has done a good job with our growth. We've tried to be responsible as we've grown. We've purchased a number of different facilities. We're in East Elementary, which is now Innovation Plaza. We've in Harmon's Grocery Store. We're in four office complexes, and of course, like Snow, we're in an old institute building. Our current science building was built in 1963 to accommodate 355 students. We've since added on to that building, but that building is simply inadequate and obsolete. This is kind of a tour of some of the spaces of this building. Infrastructurally, to teach new tech programs and also STEM programs that doesn't have the gases, doesn't have the infrastructure, the technology needed to offer this programs. This project at capacity looks at three different buildings. There in the blue is our Family Consumer Science building. We'll tear that down and we'll build the new science building over the top. Once that's completed, we'll move the current science faculty and programs into that building, which is the green building moving to the blue. The green will then become the new College of Education. The bones are good. We'll have to do a slight renovation to give them more space. And the College of Education is currently in the red space, which is the old institute building. And I'll show you a few pictures there. So let me show you a few of the areas. This is the consumer science building that we're proposing to demolition. It's 18,000 square feet, built in 1963. We're using it as overflow space. We have cubicles and classrooms to accommodate the faculty. And this, as I showed you last year, is not wallpaper coming off the wall. It is the wall actually deteriorating. And so, of course, you've got to have that one picture showing the deteriorating walls. The education building we acquired from the LDS Church, and the education building hasn't changed much since it's been an institute building. Still have a couple of the pews. The hallways are very small, the classrooms are very inadequate, and the technology is different. And we also have that unidentified smell that the subcommittee got to enjoy. And the best reaction this year was Kimberly Henry. She had to leave the building, and we were all happy about that. But this building has, we were trying to replace the floor. We thought it was tiles, and we found out that the floor was deteriorating. So in a summary for the capacity piece of this, we will demo two buildings, the Family Consumer Science Building. That's where the new science building will be constructed. We'll move the College of Education then into the science building. And we do have a need for parking like every campus, in that where the LDS Institute building is, the College of Education, it will be surface parking. As far as affordability for us, affordability and workforce really coincide with one another, so I want to share two slides with affordability and move right into workforce. For affordability, we're partners with our county, and St. George this year was named the fastest growing urban area in the United States. We also have some daunting statistics of what Washington County will look like in the next 50 years. And a very strong, robust university will be needed to meet those needs. We hear often from our county commissioners and the local mayors that it'll be important to educate the workforce, which makes this next slide a little bit scarier, as St. George has always been known as a retired community. However, the projections, it turns into more of a school age and working age community. So we'll need to be able to partner with different institutions and organizations in order to provide those workforces, which takes us into the last category. We have partnered with Intermountain Healthcare. They just completed their 400,000 square feet addition. If you haven't seen it, you need to come see it. They have partnered with us. Last year, we went together with the Department of Workforce Services to look at what the projections are for healthcare positions. In Washington County alone, there'll be 550 positions every year. If you look at the five county region, there'll be 690. And then if you are also add Iron Cane and Beaver, you'll have another 140. And so the pressure will be on us, and also on Southern Utah University. We'll both have to be addressing these openings. The tech jobs. This is a screenshot of one of our websites for our College of Science, Engineering, and Technology. They have a job board that every 10 days it updates of how many jobs there are in tech within a 300-mile radius of St. George. Just give you a visual, although I think the Mac squished this a little bit. Each of the red stars are institutions that have a similar vision for their academic plan, kind of a polytechnic vision. We also have partnered with a new development. This is the old airport up on the ridge in St. George, Tech Ridge Development. There's a couple of companies that are building up there. They're trying to create a live, work, and educate area. And we're part of that, and they have let us know how many jobs that they're going to have for us in these areas. So our case is that the university is growing, it continues to grow, our county is growing tremendously. We have a responsibility to meet those workforce demands. Workforce demands improve every year. We do have inadequate and outdated space. We've done everything possible to move into grocery stores and other areas, but now it's time to have buildings that actually address a good educational environment. And I'll close with this. As we looked at what the raw need was, Dixie State University clearly has a need. Our raw need score was 44.97. We will not compete on other funds in the near future. We have so many demands, from looking at the Human Performance Center and escalating costs there. We are also looking at building areas so that we can eat, so the kids can eat and go to the cafeteria. We also need to build housing. So with that, I will answer any questions that you might have. And Paul Morris will send out, he's going to hand out a brochure that identifies all these points.
Okay, any questions for President Williams?
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about the partnership with Intermountain and how that came about? And what was the genesis for that? I think that's one of the most exciting things I've heard in a long time, just getting a workforce ready. And
right. So Intermountain, it was first week on the job, they came over and said, here are our needs and we want to partner with you. And so we've added a number of degree programs. We've taken our traditional associate's degree nursing, made that into a four-year program. We now have an online RN to BSN. Genetic counseling for their precision genomics, we're adding genetic counseling. They're actually helping us with equipment for that genetic counseling. We just need a space. They're going to help us with salaries, internships, externships. The partnership we have with the University of Utah for PT and OT, they were good partners there. They actually came with us last year to talk to some of the legislators to say that we really need this building. They are panicking, so there's going to be a lot of jobs for us, but they're great partners.
Okay, thank you. Sanch?
Oh, I was just going to say, I actually happened to take my kids to one of your buildings for testing, and I enjoyed the waiting area and the car and the parking lot because there was no space to sit.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, President. And we'll turn the time over to President Huftelin to talk about the Harriman campus building for Salt Lake Community College.
Are we there? Great. Good afternoon, everyone. It's nice to be with you this afternoon and talk a little bit about the SLCC Harriman campus. Similar to President Williams, we decided to kind of frame my conversation around the criteria points that you as regents will be looking at as you score and make difficult decisions regarding building needs. So we're going to look at capacity, completion, affordability, and workforce. In about 2009, we commissioned as an institution and some external partners to come into the institution and look across the valley at all of our sites and let us know where we were meeting the needs in terms of higher education and where there were some gaps. And that particular 2009 campus master plan told us two things. They said you are underrepresented in terms of higher education in the northwest quadrant of Salt Lake County, and you are underrepresented in terms of the southwest quadrant. Those were both growing quadrants of Salt Lake County, but did not have high school or higher education access. So in 2010, the Board of Regents approved a purchase of property in Harriman. We have 90 acres in Harriman. Two-thirds of that was donated to the college, and a third of that we bought with your approval. And we secured that land in 2011. So we've been kind of waiting and thinking about how best to leverage that land and how to work and how to make the most meaningful contribution to higher education as we could in that area. When you look at the Southwest Quadrant, and these are just three of the cities there that really there's a few more communities that are involved, Bluffdale, Riverton, and Harriman are really some of the fastest growing communities in Utah. And that Southwest, a lot of the growth and a lot of the development has shifted to the Southwest Quadrant, and that is why when they did the projections back in 2009, and as we've seen come to fruition, the growth out there is just remarkable. And when you drill down even further to Harriman, that projected enrollment is just booming. Harriman City would like us to have been there about 2 years ago in terms of access for higher education. Their growth is nearly doubling by 2050. and Harriman City Mayor and the city planners and those that are developing around our property are very, very anxious for us to be there. There's great business opportunity there. There's real estate booming there, but there's no higher education access there. When you look at our capacity in terms of Salt Lake Community College, and I know we are dotted across the county, and that's part of what we do as a community college, the closest campus to our Harriman site is our Jordan campus, which is at 90th South in Bangor. That campus is primarily an allied health sciences campus. We were very intentional when we built that campus to focus our allied health sciences there so that we could leverage resources and equipment and some of the lab kinds of space you need for those particular programs. So we have some limited capacity at Jordan because of the nature of the programs. Many of them are cohort-based and based on accreditation standards. We can only have so many students in nursing or so many students in dental hygiene. We've grown the capacity there a little bit in terms of some of the remodeling we're doing with our student center, but there is limited capacity at the Jordan campus, and we believe that the growth, even though they feel, to an East Bench person, they feel very close to me, but when you drive out through that area, you recognize they are really not as close as we think they are. We project, and you'll see the partnership here with the University of Utah in a little bit, we project at opening that we would have immediately 1,500 students on campus, 3,000 by 2025, and that does not include the University of Utah projections, as you'll see soon in terms of our partnership. So we did a little experiment this fall. Harriman City, as I mentioned, was very anxious for us to be there. We are working on the building. We know we have to go through processes and wait our turn and get in the queue. But we wanted very much to have a presence in Harriman. So this literally at like mid-July, the city planner called us and said, we're vacating the old city hall. We've built a brand new beautiful city hall in Harriman. Would you like that space? So we pulled together gen ed courses that we knew were very high demand courses. We opened up courses in the old city hall, and within about the end of the first week of school, we had just under 200 students enrolled in those courses at that city hall. Two-thirds of those were brand new to Salt Lake Community College. They were not moving from Jordan to Harriman and just swirling within the campus. They were actually new students accessing higher education. So we think that's a good signal in terms of the demand in Harriman. When you look at that area, as I mentioned, we move into completion. One of the region's goals is to really focus on timely completion. And if you look at Harriman, Bluffdale, Riverton, and some of those communities, when you look at the Canyons and the Jordan school districts, there's approximately 20 middle schools and high schools in that cluster of communities, all with burgeoning pipelines of young students coming up through the ranks. When we presented to the subcommittee, we had the superintendent of Jordan School District there and some of her board members, and they are pleading for their students to have access to higher education. The other component of Harriman is that we know through our research with the University of Utah that there's a lot of students in the Harriman and the Southwest Quadrant that have some college and no degree. We believe that with online offerings now and additional face-to-face offerings, we'll be able to add to the degree completion of students there. And we have about a third of the Southwest Quadrant, this is the stat I was just quoting, have some college but no degree, and we believe by being there, we will create some access for them. This is the first ever joint building, I believe, with two UC institutions, so we're very proud of that. We've worked hard with Ruth and her team to identify programs that will articulate clearly from an Associate's of Science degree to a Bachelor's of Science degree, and many of those in the very, very high demand, high wage fields that we're all hearing about students needing. So we feel like we've been very intentional there. We're also going to build a lot of wraparound student services courses or services to help students access what they need to be successful and to move through those two institutions seamlessly. When you look at affordability, when you really incentivize students and market a community college experience and then a strong transfer experience, you end up saving students money. If they pay their first two years of tuition with us and then move on to the University of Utah, we anticipate in this year's dollars that we'd save students about $10,000 in the completion of their degree. We're also going to take all of our open education resource framework to Harriman and allow students some affordability measures there in terms of textbook costs. And Harriman City has stepped up nicely to the plate in terms of money in terms of infrastructure that they've donated or given to us and the things that they've set up so that we can go right into our campus and start building our building without having to worry about infrastructure needs. The mayor of Harriman, as I mentioned, is very, very interested in this project and very willing to participate and is continuing to talk about partnerships and fiscal resources that he can offer. And finally, workforce. We know that you all are, we're all worried about the skills gap and how do we create folks that can access the kinds of jobs and high demand jobs that we're going to have. We've worked with the Point of the Mountain Coalition folks to find out what are they thinking about there and how would this complement the tech industry, advanced training in the tech industry, and that kind of swirl that will happen as students are trained and then need to be retrained as technology advances. And these are those are the courses there or the programs that I think really speak to the workforce demand. I just want to close with a rendering preview of what this might look like. So our ask, and I'll just flip to that and end with this, as everybody's talked about, the escalation was frustrating to see when we've gone from 1 year to the next. The total cost is being estimated now at $55.2 million. We are bringing funds to the table. The University of Utah is bringing funds to the table. I'm very proud of outside philanthropy that we've been able to obtain as a community college. And you have a request in front of you tomorrow that has not been approved yet, but if approved, we'll have some additional dollars to help offset the costs. With that approval, the state ask would be just a little over $30 million. And I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Questions?
Do you know the number of college-aged citizens living in Harriman and Bluffdale and Draper in that greater area that you talked about? I mean, we have all the population growth. Do we know what the...
I think it was on this slide. Let me back up. I think there's 9,000 plus in the middle schools and high schools together. It's a highly, highly educated population, higher than average graduate rates. So here's approximately 9,000 ninth and 10th graders enrolled, over 20 middle schools and high schools. So, and they're building another high school now that they're almost grown out of, and there's some charter schools going up there as well. So I don't know if that helps, but estimate. Yes?
So President, what is the approximate drive time from your existing campuses to this proposed campus?
So from the Jordan campus, which is the closest campus that we have, to the Harriman campus is about a 20-minute drive. Bangor, depending on what's happening with Bangor, which is a frightening at times place to drive. It could be either shorter or longer. But I will tell you that what's important to me is the drive from Harriman to the University of Utah and what that looks like for people in terms of infrastructure, transportation, and air quality. We could really reduce that footprint by having the University of Utah closer with us at Harriman.
Is there a public transportation footprint?
Yeah, our property on the south, let me get my bearings. I think it's on the west, northwest corner of our property. They're bringing tracks in. Is that correct, Malin? There's a tracks hub that's coming right up to the end of our property, and then that will connect to various other hubs. Point of the Mountain have done some serious work around transportation hubs. Porter Rockwell, which is a new freeway, is going to go from the Mountain View corridor to I-15, and that should be done in 2020. So it's going to really connect that Harriman, that whole southwest quadrant with the Draper area. Yes?
Can you tell us what it will look like as far as faculty, and will you be able to draw from new areas for instructors?
That's a great question. I don't know. I hope so. I mean, we don't have boundaries now in terms of where our faculty can commute from and teach for us, but we do hope that we can continue to either, we might move some faculty from existing spaces and then backfill for those. There's also a lot of folks in Harriman and Saratoga Springs and on that west side that we're hoping will have the credentials and that will want to either teach adjunct or full-time for us.
Can you speak to the, what do you think comes next on this campus? You've got 90 acres and kind of the pace of development and how this
Well,
influence?
We did a master plan in 2011, I think, or 12. At that time, this was before my time, the previous president had some visions there about an energy, a lot of energy kinds of training. I think that will shift a little bit with technology. I think we've already adapted the campus master plan to look at what's going on in that city now. I don't know, so we have a master plan, we have particular buildings kind of laid out in terms of the footprint, but in terms of the disciplines and what we might teach there, I think that we're gonna have to pivot there and we're gonna have to really look at the demographics and the needs, the job needs, and try to be more mindful of that. Okay. I will say, if I can shortly, the Jordan campus, part of the land sale is that we have about 60 acres at our Jordan campus that is not developed on the south end. And part of what we're doing is taking 30 of those acres off the table and selling them to add to the cost of the Harriman campus. We still feel like that will be somewhat build outable, but the master plan we had for the Jordan campus 25 years ago doesn't make sense anymore, and we had to be flexible. So we're selling the land there and investing it in Harriman to try to follow the growth.
Very good. Any other questions? Thank you very much, sure. President. We'll turn the time over to President Tumines to speak about the new business school building at UVU.
I just borrowed a handheld microphone, but I'm not going to sing, don't worry. Is this a Mac? Or how do I expand the, sorry, I am a Microsoft user. How do I put it on slideshow? Sorry, wrong technology for this president. Good afternoon, it's wonderful to be here. My first Board of Regents meeting. And so this is my foreword. So I'm here to talk about our ask for a new building for our Woodbury School of Business. And buildings are not necessarily my specialization, but I realize that when you're a university president, you've got to be a Jane of all trades. So I started my job on Mondays, my fourth day on the job, and my seventh week in the great state of Utah. And of course, this is my first day, and a lot of people ask me this question, what are your big plans? And I realized that the only way to kind of tackle that question is to come to work with green toenails. for UVU. So the story of UVU and this building is the perfect storm of growth. And some of these slides, I have quite a few slides, so I'll try to go fast. The story of the growth of Utah, and then the growth of Utah County itself. So this is in 40 years, but from 623,000 to 1.62 million. And I think this slide is particularly interesting because if you look at the share of population, there is a shift towards Utah County. And it's also an exciting story because it's not just population growth, but job growth as well. 6% in Utah County versus a national average of 1.6%. And if you look at the jobs that will be in demand, many of them will be underpinned by training that is offered, education that is offered at the business school. I'll just skip that slide. So there's that growth of Utah, growth of jobs, growth of UVU. In fact, in my time in the 80s, I lived in Provo and went to BYU. Nobody would have expected back then that, you know, this is the trajectory you would see, but that is what it is today. The final numbers aren't in, but I think by October, first week of October, we'll have numbers that will show that we are very close to 40,000, the whole school, and the business school itself is growing, and we have some numbers on that in a second. So the student demographics, I think what's very special about UVU is that in our service area as a whole, we are catering towards many non-traditional students. Of course, we have the full-time, four-year, first-time, full-time, four-year university students, but that's only about 14% of our population. And this is exciting because in a day and age when barriers to so many things have fallen down, I believe that barriers to education have also fallen, and this is the picture of the student body at UVU. And what's exciting is that some of the largest growth, of course, is with our juniors and seniors. So we're getting towards that, you know, student success, not just as words, but student success in reality and what's happening there. And we are graduating more and more people. We have also the largest headcount for schools in the UC system. And here you see this is now Woodbury School of Business, and you can see the projections here for enrollment by the year 2020 and then by the year 2025. So it's really, so growth is the story up to this point in time. Here, this is the same thing, just presented to you in a different graphic. In the fall 2017, we have 15,949 students in the Woodbury School of Business. All degrees are represented here with a master's growing in a very big way. So if you look at that, you'll see the expansion of the growth for students enrolling in the MBA program. This is a great slide. Maybe I don't have to say very much about this, but this is a great slide because if you look at UVU, look at that light green FTEs, and then look at the capital development. So I guess my plea is when you look at this slide, the story is we have more FTEs, and yet the investment in UVU has been smaller relative to other institutions in the UC system. And this doesn't mean that I don't love the other seven institutions in the UC system. So I think this is something to focus on. Again, square footage, this is in your handout, the hard copy that is at your desks, where UVU, I think, is the second lowest for square feet per FTE student. And as a whole, just academic square footage, again, per FTE student, very low for UVU relative to other institutions in UC. And I love this slide, sort of people playing a game on a board. And so if you compare, I think this is with Woodbury School of Business versus peer institutions, business schools. You can see that UVU in the same amount of space would have 35 students versus 12 in the peer group. And I've just come from Southeast Asia where everything's very crowded. You go to Jakarta, Manila, Bangkok, this is sort of the scenario. In terms of our programmatic cost effectiveness, the numbers tell you the story that our expenditure per FTE is 16% below the UC average. So we are quite efficient. Thank you, I have 5 minutes. And a lot of recognition for the programmatic strengths of UVU's business school. I marked the CFA pass rate in red because I know how difficult it is to pass that exam, and the fact that we had 100% pass rate is quite remarkable. So I will move forward to Where we are with the old building, there are structural limitations and there are risks if you break down walls or do anything to that building that it might not hold together. So there is a need to really bring in new investment into the space. And this is the ask. The total building will be 180,000 new square feet. And the idea here is to bring our Woodbury School of Business into sort of 21st century space with all of that entails, including the ability to deliver innovative education. And some of that is captured here, specialty labs, including SMART, which I understand is where we do marketing using a lot of technology, big data, and so on. This is also part of our master plan, which has been approved by the board. And there's already been investment made in the design phase, and this is going to be a very environmentally sound building with great energy efficiency, similar to the new buildings that we have built on campus, like our Clark classroom building. The old space, we intend to repurpose that so that it will still be usable and repurpose that towards uses that its design and quality are a better fit. So in the coming years, we will be able to bring in, this is the repurposing of the new building, the obsolete space, put to new uses. This is what it looks like at rush hour. And again, so I hope this picture captures more than 1,000 words. The other exciting thing is that the partnerships in the Valley, as you know, a lot of activities going on there. So not only government, the Governor's Office of Economic Development, but also businesses. We have strong partnerships, and this is something that we intend to develop further. We intend to strengthen our partnerships with tech companies and our Woodbury School of Business. Our Center of Entrepreneurship will be receiving some new investment, and we intend to grow that as well. We believe that with this investment in the new building, we will be able to enhance retention and completion of the students and enable them to move in that pipeline towards employment and meet the employment needs that are very real in Utah County. When we look at the governor's economic development objectives, three of those, we are completely aligned. This kind of investment would align completely to what the state would like to get done. The other amazing thing is that a lot of our graduates stay in Utah. So the Wolverines like to stay in the state of Utah, and that investment that is made in the building, this yellow highlighted area here, is that for every dollar invested by the state in UVU, there is a return investment of $8, and that's been measured in terms of employment, taxes, and so on. And I think that's a very compelling point. So if you look again, these are sort of additional things to think about, that with the new building completion, the completion of students will improve. The capacity for new purposes with the older building will also increase. The affordability both education and the outcomes here that we want will be enhanced by our partnerships with the institutions that are named there, and we hope to be able to make a better contribution to the workforce that is much needed by the state of Utah. I know I have 1 minute, and thankfully there's no cauldron of boiling water above me, so I will end here, and I'll be happy to answer questions. I also have two colleagues in the back who are better experts in infrastructure and buildings, so we'll be able to help and answer the questions if they are specifics that I don't quite have with me today.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from Regents?
Yes.
One question. I was wondering, the return of investment was calculated. How is it additional income and additional taxes that people are going to pay, or is it the people staying in the state that?
So the question is, how did we calculate that for every dollar that the state invests in UVU, we get $8 back? Do you know the methodology, Val? Do you know the methodology that's behind that? I would assume that it is, I would assume that the answer is both. Those who stay and then work here and pay taxes. Or wages generated.
Yeah, that was just standard. Outside consultant that ran for the university, and so when they did that,
multiplying factors in there. That's how you get the $8.04 for every dollar that's contributed by the state.
Okay.
Some magical formula.
Yes. I mean, it is actually, in my experience, it's not uncommon for these kinds of studies to be done, and you certainly will have indicators, and my own sort of commonsensical explanation for that would be that you calculate that for every dollar, how many students graduate, how many stay in Utah, how many of them get employed, what kind of taxes are paid from that kind of employment. And that's the kind of data that I think the university has tracked and will continue to track because it's important to show what actually happens to these dollars.
I was trying to compare if they go to UVU, what would be the return on investment, and if they don't go to UVU and still continue to stay here, what would be the differential?
You mean if they went to another institution versus UVU? I don't know the answer to that. Teresa?
I don't have the answer, but I have a question.
Sure.
I just noticed, I didn't see it in the presentation, if it was there, I'm really sorry, I missed it. But it shows that you're asking for 56 million state funds and 14 in other funds. Is that, oh.
Actually, sorry, this is the last slide. Yes, so the total ask is $63,998,000, but the total project cost is just over $74 million.
So this is one of the buildings that changed with the inflationary impacts of being negotiated with the facilities construction management. So we have $11 million donated funds. Our project costs went up a little over $3 million on this project because of inflation. So our request is for the $63.9 million.
Okay, so the $14 million in our hand.
$11 million. So to repeat that, $11 million in donor funds, Val, is that correct? Okay.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
President, we appreciate that very much. All right. I'll turn the time over to, really pleased to welcome Dr. Daniel Reed, new Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at the University of Utah, to talk about their proposed project.
Thank you. I'm going to let Henry White, who's Dean of the College of Science, kick off, and I'll offer a few final comments.
One of my goals here is to save 2 or 3 minutes for Dan to provide some concluding remarks on his perspective of the importance of this job, of this building project. Let's see. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Henry White. I'm the Dean of the College of Science, and I'm going to present our project entitled Interdisciplinary Physical Science Education and Research Building. The first slide I have here gives an overview of the objectives of this particular project. And I'm going to address each one of these in my presentation. So in a nutshell, let me just summarize that the first two bullet items up there really describe the driving force for this project, and that's to meet the increase, the remarkable increase in STEM enrollment at the University of Utah, and to meet the demand for workforce and professional STEM occupations, health sciences, engineering, and so on. One of the other objectives is to restore the William Stewart Building, the bottom photo there, which is just off of President's Circle. This is a 100-year-old building. Part of the project is to restore that building and to expand by nearly 200% the current square footage. The other part of this project is to decommission the James Fletcher Building, which is on the north side of the campus, which has just become functionally obsolete and has all types of code issues. So as I think we all recognize, STEM jobs in the state of Utah continue to be a significant driver of the economy and will continue to increase in the future in importance. Nationwide, STEM, the average STEM-based occupation salary is almost $90,000. That's nearly twice that of non-STEM jobs. And that trend, those numbers reflect also what's occurring in the state of Utah. All these STEM-based jobs require post-secondary education. And what I know as the Dean of Science, I have this discussion all the time with presidents of companies, is they cannot hire undergraduates receiving degrees in STEM-based majors fast enough. I've even heard a story in recent times of a company deciding whether to expand in Utah or to expand in Michigan, and that decision is being largely driven by their ability to recruit undergraduates with strong degrees in STEM majors. In the state of Utah, this is across all the Yishi schools, the number of STEM majors graduating has increased by 40% over the last 7 years. The University of Utah produces nearly half of those graduates. Physical sciences is a foundation, cornerstone of STEM education. 37% of all the undergraduates at the University of Utah are required to take a course or multiple courses in physical sciences to meet the requirements for 24 degrees. In addition, there's 9 pre-professional programs that require coursework in the in physical sciences. If you look at this in a little bit more detail, there's 8 engineering programs that require coursework in physical sciences. And that's, as you know, I think many of you know, over the last 15 years, the number of undergraduates graduating in engineering from the College of Engineering at Utah has increased by well over 100%. And that's put a great demand on our ability in the College of Science to train those students. These engineering students spend their first 2 years in the College of Science, taking math classes, chemistry classes, physics, and so on. And currently, we're so over capacity in physical sciences, especially the undergraduate courses, that we're not able to provide those meet the instructional needs for the engineers. And we've seen a decrease, actually, the number of engineering students taking these courses because this has become such a bottleneck in their education. This is completely out of line with Pac-12, our peer Pac-12 institutions, where there is a rigorous training in physical sciences before the engineering students get to their own coursework. Our students, when they graduate, they're essentially employed the moment they walk out the door. And this is a short list of companies in the state of Utah that hire students graduating with a degree in physical sciences. Not only are they in high demand, they also are very competitive in terms of their starting salary. And these are number statistics for starting salaries across the entire university. The actual salaries are significantly higher for those students graduating with a STEM degree. This slide tells two stories. The first story, which is good news, is that STEM enrollment at the University of Utah and the graduation rate for those students are at a record high. So the number of students is increasing, and we're getting them out better trained more quickly out into employment in the state. The second story, which is the challenging news, is that in 2018, we are at record high, and we're simply over capacity in our ability to offer instructional needs, especially with undergraduate labs where these students really get their hands-on training. And as you see, the enrollment's going to go up, and we're at a point where we really need this building in order to properly train students graduating in STEM majors. Our project involves renovation of the Stewart Building, 40,000 square foot renovation, an addition of 1,000 square feet of new space. Less than 10% of this space will be used for administrative purposes. The budget is estimated at roughly $85 million. We're asking for $60 million from the state, $25 million in private donations. We're talking to lead donors on this project at the moment. We're very confident. We've done this before recently with the Crocker Science Building, where we raised $21 million to complete that building. We're confident of the private fundraising capabilities. As I mentioned, we're going to demolish the James Fletcher Building, where all these courses are currently being taught, and that's really driven by financial need. The expense for seismic upgrade, infrastructure upgrade, is almost six times larger than what we're going to propose, what we're proposing for the Stewart Building. Additionally, the space is just functionally obsolete. There's been two engineering studies done on this building in the last decade that recommend that the building be torn down or repurposed, and we're going to tear it down. The Stewart Building is, you can see a photo from 1925, built at a cost, you might enjoy this, built at a cost of $90,000. The times have changed. Built in 1919, so it's 99 years old. It served as a elementary school for many years, and then as K-12 school. And the cost of bringing it up, the infrastructure cost, seismic up cost, you can see is $6 million, which is less than about $37 million for the Fletcher Building. This space, the Stewart Building, also provides, it's located in an area where there's some expansion space, one of the few spots on the University of Utah main campus where there is room for expansion for a building like this. The benefits of this is the ability to handle enrollment growth. We're going to expand our undergraduate laboratories by almost 60%. That's a big goal of this particular project. There'll be additional classroom and lecture halls, an increase of 20,000 square feet. For that purpose, the building will also house our K-12 teacher education and outreach centers. And we're restoring a beautiful old historic building. Dan?
I'll be very brief. I wanted you to hear from Henry because he expressed the pain that as a dean is experiencing with this. Look, we're in a global competition for talent in the U.S. and within Utah, we're in a competition for talent within the United States. Imagine a world where STEM workers can actually be trained in laboratories. The College of Engineering at Utah actually discontinued laboratory courses as a requirement because there's a lack of capacity. This is the challenge we face. If we can expand capacity, we can train more talent, we can grow the Utah economy, we can maintain a competitive, preeminent position. It's that simple. And we'd be happy to answer questions.
Questions? Maybe I'll start with one. Can you talk about how the cost, kind of cost per foot, compares to the Crocker Science Building project? This looks like it's about $600 per foot for 140,000 feet, including the renovation view. How would that compare to the Crocker project?
Robin, I'm going to ask Robin Burr in the back, that knows these answers better than I do. Robin?
The costs are absolutely on par with Crocker with the inflation.
Okay. How does the cost break out? That was one of my questions along the same lines, Chair. What is the new construction of the 100,000 new square feet versus the 42,000 that's being renovated? I mean, was it 6.8? Was that the number?
The 6.8 is for the seismic and infrastructure upgrade.
Okay,
that's that part. That's for the Stewart Building.
How many square feet up?
That's 40,000 square feet. That doesn't include the renovation installing.
Yeah, how much more of that?
So we can get you the breakout. We evaluated tearing down the Stewart Building and building a new 140,000 square foot building, and it's a little more than $100 a square foot less to retain the Stewart Building, plus we save an historic asset.
So that's exactly what I was going to say. This was the cheaper of all the options we looked at, and it's a high-profile historic building on President Circle. It's one of the original icons of the university.
I think that's all great, but I do think it's important to look at the cost per square foot of a renovation and the cost per square foot of new construction blended together, we have no concept of what either is.
We have it broken out.
Thank you.
Yeah, we have those numbers. We'd be happy to give them to you.
Okay. Other questions?
We've got the estimate here. We want the renovation cost is $345 a square foot.
And the new space is
$430.
Thank you very much.
That's why I was saying it was cheaper to renovate than it was to tear it out and build.
I mean, the $345 and $430, and yet the total is $600. So I'm not quite sure how that.
Yes.
Just to clarify, those are construction costs for the installation to apply to extend it out for years in the future. I'm just giving you a relative difference between the model versus the.
And I don't think that's including the seismologic. Yeah, I don't know. I can't. Okay. Well, does that include the 6.8?
Yes, it does. Okay.
No. It doesn't include inflation. So that was.
No.
Yeah. Because it, $84 million for 140,000 feet, 600. So that includes the demolition of the Fletcher building, then, too?
That's correct.
Yeah, that's all included.
And restoration of the other. I wouldn't think it would be that much, but somewhere the number is mentioned.
Yeah.
You understand what we're saying?
Yes, we do. It's because we're talking construction costs and soft costs, and we're talking today's costs and escalating costs. So we will sort that out for you. We've got it.
Well, does the $84 million include all of the furnishings and things like that? So there's some additional costs that would be added to it. But tearing down the Fletcher building would be some
installing laps and everything. Yeah.
Yes, it's a complete.
So I don't know what else is not in there.
Okay.
So I have a general question. It could be aimed at anyone, but we always ask about the life expectancy, or I do. Of a building, what do you project the new build life to be? And then compare that with how do we have a Stewart building that's been around for 99 years and served us with the investment?
The 99-year-old building has not served us well.
Okay.
For the last 20, since I've been here for 25 years. It's really office, it's been used as dusty, dingy old office space in a few classrooms. The life expectancy, I'm going to again refer to Ken or Robin in the back. The question was about the life expectancy of the building, is that correct?
Building and buildings in general.
And buildings in general.
Well, we try to build 50-plus year buildings, understanding that systems have to be renewed depending on the component at other intervals along the way. And I think if you look at the Stewart building, the Fletcher building, you're seeing a lesson in time in history when buildings were stout and well-made, and the 1965 building that is a soft-story building on unreinforced skinny pillars with overstressed sheer walls and diaphragms. And it was 1965 was a bad period in our community.
It was. There was a building boom here on this campus that was not well thought out in terms of longevity and stoutness.
Thank you.
In the 60s.
The other questions?
I think the numbers do add up. I just think that the number they gave, the 640, wasn't the number we have. I think they've included other costs.
Yeah.
So I do think just for our straight, the 345 per foot on the renovation and the 430 does come to the total that's on that.
Those are project costs.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate the presentation. And we'll go next to our interim president, Norm Tarbox from Weber State, talk about their engineering applied science building.
Appreciate the opportunity to present today. Weber State University's College of East Engineering, Applied Science and Technology consists of many high-quality, industry-driven technical programs that serve northern Utah and beyond. The health and growth of the college is vital to the region's economy. here are a few fast facts about Weber State's College of East. It has established 8 new, fully supported, accredited, and highly subscribed programs in the past 5 years. Its recent growth in graduates exceeds all other USHE institutions in engineering and computer science, both in percentage terms and in raw numbers. It has been the fastest growing college at Weber State over the last 10 years, and without doubt, it has functionally the worst space on campus. A couple of years ago, after significant planning, we determined that the best way to meet the space needs for East moving forward was with a 3-phase project to renew and build anew every single square foot that East utilizes. This 3-phase project, for obvious reasons, has acquired the name the Fidget Spinner. The 3 phases being the building of a computer and automotive engineering building at the Davis campus, primarily with gift funding. The building of the Norda Engineering Building on the Ogden campus, primarily with state funding, and to renovate the existing engineering technology building on the Ogden campus with a combination of state capital improvement funding and university capital funding. Here's a depiction of the 3 phases, starting out at Davis, moving to phase 2 with the Norda building, and finally circling back and renovating the engineering technology building. In the end, what is now 162,000 square feet of 50-year-old obsolete space will be converted into 254,000 square feet of high-quality instructional space. We will talk today primarily about the Norda Engineering Building, since it is our capital development request for this cycle, but just know that this is part of a 3-phase process to completely renew the space for our East College. With that as an introduction, we've organized the remainder of this presentation according to the Regents' criteria points to help you with your scoring. The first Regent priority is timely completion. Our job is to, our project needs to improve the timely completion of students graduating with degrees and certificates. The first way we will accomplish this with the Norda Engineering Building is by extending our current partnership with NewAIMS to the Ogden campus. For those of you who don't know, NewAIMS is the number one performing high school in the state of Utah and has been a partner at Weber State's Davis campus for the past 10 years. This fall, for the first time, 200 NewAIMS students begin taking courses on the Ogden campus. It is anticipated that this branch of NewAIMS will reach 500 over the next few years. NewAIMS provides a pipeline of highly motivated, technically prepared students for our programs in East. There they can choose from any number of high demand, high paying programs to pursue. In this way, Weber State can meet the needs of growing industry needs in the area for technically trained workforce, and these motivated students can move through their academic careers and into the world of work quickly and seamlessly. It would be difficult for me to overstate the value of bringing this NewAIMS partnership to Ogden and providing our diverse community this opportunity for their children. And the Norda Engineering Building will enable this partnership to be a permanent one by providing the needed space. Additionally, the College of East has been the most successful entity in our state system in securing strategic workforce initiative funding. This legislatively sponsored program provides funding for institutions willing to partner and build stackable, workforce-oriented programs. Here are 4 such programs that have been created among Weber State, our local tech colleges, and the community colleges. All 4 include, as a partner, our College of East, and each has been designed to allow students to advance quickly and seamlessly through various stages of schooling and career without the typical backslide that can happen when institutions fail to cooperate and plan. This is regional workforce training at its best. The second region priority is capacity. Our project is to improve space utilization, eliminate functional obsolescence, and increase capacity. First, it's important to note that East has been very aggressive at marketing STEM as a career choice for students of all types and backgrounds. Here's a partial list of the outreach programs we use to interest our local pre-college students in our technical programs. These efforts are paying off. This chart shows the number of East majors by program over the last 10 years. And this one shows that our graduates in computer science and engineering have more than doubled over the past 7 years. This 7-year change exceeds that of any of our sister institutions over the same period of time. And we are pleased to report that this strong growth has occurred among all demographics, including minorities and women. But we are attempting to do all of this in grossly inadequate facilities. Our current tech ed building, which is slated to come down to make way for the Nordic Engineering Building, is a relic from a previous era, containing poorly functioning space and grossly outdated equipment. A list of deficiencies highlight our need for better space and increased capacity. We are not showing you falling ceilings and rusty water this year, but we could. Suffice it to say that because of the condition of the Tech Ed building, the NORDA project has been granted 9 well-deserved life safety points. We need to move our students out of Cold War era facilities and temporary annexes and into state-of-the-art classrooms and labs where they can meet their full potential. Again, the end result of the fidget spinner is 250,000 square feet of up-to-date functional instructional space. The third region priority is affordability. Our project needs to leverage cost-effective partnerships. We have attempted to do this in several ways. The New Ames partnership is not just a programmatic one, but it also addresses capital. New Ames has committed $7.5 million in capital dollars for the construction of the NORDA Engineering Building to help defray the costs of construction. In addition, the College of East has secured the single largest gift in the history of Weber State to help build programs and facilities. The capital portion of this gift will spread across all 3 phases of the fidget spinner, including the NORDA Engineering Building phase. And to further provide economy, there is several thousand square feet of high value, high bay space in the current Tech Ed building that will be retained and incorporated into the design of NORDA, providing further efficiency to the project. Given all of the partnerships, private funding, and efficiencies built into this project, it is worth noting that for the entire fidget spinner, although the cost will be approximately $330 per square foot, which is an all-in full project cost number, our ask in terms of state funding is $186 per square foot, a real bang for the state buck. And now finally to region priority number 4, workforce. Our project should enhance state and regional workforce needs. It would be difficult to find a college better aligned with our regional workforce needs than the College of East. Here is a slide showing the top 10 high demand jobs worldwide and which are addressed by our East programs. East is also an exceptional example of a college that listens to industry and tailors its programs specifically for regional workforce needs. Each of the employers highlighted here are active participants in our East Industry Advisory Board and benefit directly from the technically trained graduates produced by our programs. It is vital that the linkages between what they need and what we teach remain tight, and our close partnerships with industry ensures that this happens. Finally, one more look at the need for skilled employees in our region and the obvious overlap that exists with our College of East. In summary, we believe that the Norda Engineering Building is a very strong project and measures up exceptionally well to the Regent priorities of timely completion, capacity, affordability, and workforce. And one final parenthetical, in addition to the Dixie State project, our project also was authorized to move forward with design. We have done so, and the design is expected to be complete sometime in the spring of 2019. I appreciate your attention.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions for Mr. Tarbox?
What were those guys doing in that picture?
Playing with very old equipment.
No idea what they were doing.
I couldn't see the pocket haircuts. Protectors quite. any questions? Thank you very, very
Thank
much.
You.
We appreciate that. And finally, we'll turn the time to President Wyatt to speak to the SUU project for the Technology Engineering Design Building.
All right. All I have to do is find it. Ah, look at that right there. So this really is an honor to be here, and I appreciate your trust and confidence in allowing me the privilege of representing Southern Utah University. It's been an exceptional experience, and I'm delighted to present to you today relative to our capital project. In 11 years of making these presentations, I've never been so direct as to say, I am specifically asking you to prioritize our building number one. And it's my intention to show you the reasons for that. And the points are such that you can do it within the formula that you've been given. This project, I'd like to also mention, 75% of SUU students are Utah residents, and half of those are urban students. We have students from every county in the state, and our students return to all corners of the state to work and be engaged. And I'm going to try to run through pieces of this quick and other pieces slowly. I'm leaving tomorrow after the committee meeting because I have to get to a check-in time for an ultra marathon that's a fundraiser for my school. So if I leave and for some reason you rank as second instead of first, it's not because I'm mad. It's because I have to run. But all of the data that you will see presented on the slides and in this booklet are data that comes straight from the office, from the system office. And so I'm not picking the time frames. I'm just copying things out of the data book and what has been sent to us. So this is the project, Technology, Engineering, and Design Building. This building will be the primary home for computer science, math, engineering, and some of our art department, in particular the graphic design, the computerized portion of art, will be the primary tenants, but it will serve the entire campus. We just, yesterday I received an email from one of our computer science faculty members who said that our aspirations for women in technology chapter, there's 97 chapters of this across the country. We have a conference every year, and so far, we have the second largest number of girls who have registered to come out of all chapters in the country, beat only by one chapter in the Bay Area. So we're really working hard to expand STEM and to make sure that young women and young men all are welcome and succeed in those programs. Your criteria points are divided up into four different categories that make 10, and then 15 points is discretion. And in order to save some time, we have put all of the analysis for each of the points in this book one at a time. So you can thumb through that. That will help me move along and get to the points that I really want to emphasize on. The first one is completion points. SUU has the least amount of square foot of any university or college in Utah. The second one is capacity, and SUU has grown faster than any other university in Utah. I'm going to show you some data to support that in a few minutes. So this will certainly help, under your standards, to improve the institution's capacity to serve growing student populations. Affordability, this project is going to help us with our partnership with Southwest Tech. I believe that affordability in part or in whole relates to partnering with other organizations. And this will help us with that great program. And by the way, the first cohort of students who are in computer science has begun, and they're going through spectacularly well. And the whole program will be up and running by January. Workforce points, you're going to see in the book that I've handed to you in more detail than what you can see on this slide. The primary tenets, engineering, computer science, mathematics, and design, we've listed in the booklet all of the majors offered in these disciplines, plus the employment rate for the students in those disciplines, plus the list of five-star Utah jobs. And if you know what the five-star jobs mean, that is the jobs with high income and high growth. So they are the best kind of jobs. And I just got a five-minute note. So now let me move to, and I'll be willing to answer any questions about that first section, but let me move to the discretionary points. Number one, Southern Utah University has raised more money for the capital projects over the last 10 years than any institution in Utah as a percent of the total cost, save only the University of Utah. Second, we have the least amount of square foot per student of anybody in Utah. If you look at the academic square feet as a comparison, what's interesting about this is that Southern Utah University has devoted a higher percentage of its square feet for academics than any other institution. 54% has been devoted to academics. These numbers, you might be interested to know, it had not dawned on me until this week, but these numbers of students per square feet include online students who'd never step on our campus and concurrent enrollment students who never step on our campus. And so this is a report that you're looking at that comes from the system office. And as you can see, some of the institutions have more than 10,000 students who are concurrent enrollment students who don't step on their campus. Southern Utah University has a very small number. And the University of Utah folks have even a greater reason to be concerned about this. I submit to you that the number of concurrent enrollment students, which are in the calculations, are not relevant to how many classrooms we need on our campuses. And so when you look at the fact that SUU has the least square feet per student and also has by far the least number of concurrent enrollment students, it dramatically exaggerates our need relative to everyone else. The next thing I want to show you is that over the last 22 years, the total amount of project money that has come to SUU for development is by far lower than any other institution. And we've never been ranked in the top half. Now, it's possible that 4 or 5 or 6 years ago, we didn't deserve to be ranked in the top half. And it's possible that our projects haven't been explained well enough. But I think that every once in a while, every institution, depending on the circumstances and the ebb and flow and how the needs and demands change, I submit to you it's SUU's turn to be ranked in the top half. And today I'm asking that you rank us number one. Growth and outcomes. The growth of students as a percent has been higher at SUU than any other university in Utah, and we have seen, as I explained and you, we were able to discuss when you were on our campus, that outcomes have also grown spectacularly well. Now, what I did for the growth is just go to the data book and took all of the tabs relating to growth and just put them all in this presentation so you can see every way we count growth. And if you look at budget related, FTE, SUU's been the highest over the last 4 years. Budget and self-support, SUU's the highest. Annualized FTE budget related only, Snow College beat us out by 0.2. Annualized total budget related and self-support, Snow College is the only one that was ahead, but we've been ahead of everybody. And as you look at this, some schools have gone down in numbers and some have gone up, but SUU has led. Headcount budget related only, again, SUU's the leader. And headcount budget related and self-support, again, Southern Utah University has been the leader. So after, over the last 4 or 5 years, SUU has grown the most, has seen the least amount of investment in new facilities, has seen considerable increase in outcomes, has raised the largest percentage of funds for its capital projects, save only the University of Utah, and has the least amount of square feet per student. Did I mention we have the least amount of square feet per student? Anyway, I think that my time is spent. I have one more minute. My summary is this: the leader in growth, leader in outcomes, leader in raising funds, second only to the U. The loser, I don't mean that word negatively, but the loser in square feet per student and the loser in new state funds per capita projects. I humbly and respectfully request that you take your discretionary points you have available for you and spend a sufficient amount to rank SUU's project number one and make it the first time in my memory that we have ever been ranked number one. We should win at least once in a decade, particularly with this data. Thank you very much, and questions.
Questions? Yeah,
you're right. If you don't answer this question, you don't have to, because it doesn't directly relate to the project, but it does. Do you think this process is working? I mean, you obviously don't, but what could be improved?
I'd take concurrent enrollment out.
You think that one metric would change?
I'd adjust online. I would not, I would reward institutions who save their buildings rather than reward us for tearing them down. SUU doesn't tear down buildings. This last project, the business building, was an $8 million state expenditure. When you look at the money that's being spent on buildings, we asked for eight. We raised more than 13. And that amount of money allowed us to remodel the old science, the old business building into a beautiful new science building and build a new business building, but we're penalized by the scoring because we saved the building. And anytime an institution, in this case, with a new tech building, the fact that we're just building a new building on new land means that we don't qualify to even ask for 10 points that can be awarded to an institution for solving obsolete or dangerous space. So that really seems to me to be unfair. But I do believe that that's why you have 15 discretionary points, is to say, that makes sense to us. Congratulations, SUU, for only charging $8 million for the last building and saving buildings and all that kind of stuff. I'm glad you asked the question.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Last one. Thank you very much.
Well, we appreciate that. So if you'll finish up your own scoring on the scorecards, while you're doing that, in just a minute, Rich will gather these up. Before we adjourn, just two things. We're going to take, I'm going to ask Regent Anderson to take just about 5 minutes and talk about the Our Schools Now initiative that will be on the ballot here on November 6th. And it has a lot of, obviously means a lot to higher education and a huge amount to public education. And so if you'll take kind of 5 minutes and do that, and while and before you do that, just another, when we finish here, the Capital Facilities Committee will meet, I think, is it in this
Sorenson,
room? Or
No, Sorenson Legacy Room.
Sorenson Legacy Room, someplace
sure
in this building.
We'll figure it out.
Anybody else who would be interested, we have arranged for a tour of the Lassonde studio just close by here, and so if you're interested, just gather out here in the lobby, and we'll take anybody who's interested up to Lassonde.
Great.
Jessely, would you like to?
I'll just stay here. First of all, none of this money, should this ballot question pass, can be used for construction, so it's not going to help us on this ranking, regretfully. Bob Marquardt and myself, and also Nolan Karras, a former regent, have been way more involved in this Our Schools Now project than we ever imagined. And through a lot of different configurations, we reached a compromise with the legislature in the final days of the session to withdraw what we had hoped to have been a ballot initiative to raise funds for K through 16. And out of it came a compromise whereby the legislature asked us to help try and get a 10-cent gas tax passed. And why would a 10-cent gas tax be important to higher education? Well, first of all, it means about $25 million new dollars. I want to stress new dollars. This doesn't mean if it's passed, you'll lose money from other state funds. This is new money. And going through each of the schools, I've rounded these figures off, but at UVU, $3 million, University of Utah, $7 million, Salt Lake Community College, $3 million, SUU, $5 million, Dixie State University, $1 million, Weber State, $3 million, SUU, $1 million, and Snow College, $1 million. What would you do with an annual donor like that? So this is very, very important. And this is new funding annually. It will be rolled over into the performance funding, which is already in place. So you keep doing what you're doing with performance funding, but you have this extra $25 million. I want to publicly thank our presidents. They have been extraordinary in their efforts to help support this. And they have reached out to their donors, which are highly prized, loyal fans, and asked them to help. And I really want to publicly thank each one of you for doing that. Aside from getting this ballot initiative a ballot question passed, and my apologies if, Val Hill's left, okay, good, is there's a really underlying issue that is of great concern to me and to anyone, all of us at this table, but most of you don't understand what I'm going to say, and that is that when the legislature reached out to us in the final days of the session to negotiate with them, knowing that we had well in excess of the certified signatures to get this on the ballot, every time we met, there was not one mention of higher ed from any of the legislators. And every time we made it clear that was the deal breaker to us. They felt like they didn't want any money to go to higher ed. To me, that represents an issue that we have to face. And even last week, there has been a legislative group working together so that we could announce exactly what the legislation would be. Should this question pass, the governor has agreed to call a special session. He wants this session of the legislature that negotiated the compromise to vote on it. We don't want any problem of waiting to the new legislative session and having them say, well, we didn't make that compromise. So a working group has been meeting, and Bob Marquardt has represented our organization. The same thing has been happening. Every time we get to language where we spell out the distribution, they say, oh, we don't need to clarify higher ed. And we got it in, and it was announced yesterday. Of the money that goes to to our schools now, 20% goes to higher ed, 80% to public ed. They did not want that spelled out. So my concern for all of us is to be aware that we have a situation where higher ed, the perception is our students can pay the cost through increased tuition. And there's not one of us in this room that would say that is the best solution. But anyway, the other side of this is 80% of this money would go to K through 12. And that is going to better prepare our students coming in. I mean, we know Salt Lake Community College, half of the students have to take remedial courses. They have to pay for those courses and they don't get any credit. What a great way to start out. So anyway, $150 per student, K through 12, it goes right in the classroom. It is not part of the WPU. The local school and the teachers and the community council will decide. It can't be used for construction, for building construction or hiring teachers. So quickly, this is very, very important. And I hope that all of you will do whatever you can to encourage your students, your faculty, to get out and vote, because there is a lot at stake. And again, I just want a last thing, thank you to each of you presidents for all that you've done to support this.
Thank you very, very much. Questions? Yeah, Regent Jones. Anything you'd like to add?
I would just want to suggest, I'm sure staff is aware, I mean, if this passes, this will be quick, and that we're looking forward in uses. I'm sure presidents are considering what would happen with this, but it's an opportunity to be prepared when this happens.
We just encourage all of you within your spheres of influence to do what you can to spread the word. This is really critical for, we all know, you know, it's well publicized what's going on with public education and per student funding challenges we have in this state with a big population. You know, less well understood probably the challenges we have in higher education. But this is maybe the best opportunity we'll see in a generation to really try to address some of these issues in a way that can make a big difference. So, President White, do you have a comment?
Yes, thank you. I just would like to add to what Regent Anderson said, and I'd be interested in your take on this comment, but it seems to me that if this fails, that the legislature might say it's clear that the public's not interested in increasing funding for education. So on the one hand, if it passes, then we're ahead of where we currently are. If it fails, we might be set back.
Well, I think one of the challenges we have is the public who's not paying attention to this very much, when they see a gas tax, I think we have to worry about their connecting the dots and really right. understanding how the money moves. And so that makes it doubly important that we try to educate them and say that, you know, this is really an education benefit that we're talking about.
In our circles of influence, I think we can, this room can yep. make a difference.
Yep.
I just would like to add, President White is right on. If this doesn't pass, they are going to pat themselves on the back and say, you know, we are doing just exactly what the people want. And I know that it'll be 7 or 8 years before you get another group that builds this kind of momentum to get their attention for them to even think of it again. And so it is really important. But I want to caution you, because we don't want to open ourselves to any criticism. Don't use your school emails. Send it out on anything you do, send out on your personal email.
If I may, let me just make one clarification. We have shared some legal guidance to the presidents, and it is perfectly appropriate for presidents to voice their support. In fact, the statute even says of a ballot question or ballot initiative. What is not where the line is if they are actually campaigning using state resources. So they could share their opinion that they're in support of it, as long as they're not making a campaign statement of contribute money or urging vote per se, electioneering. But if they're saying, this would be helpful to me, this would be helpful to our institution, I'm supportive of it, here's why, that is appropriate.
Good.
Just to clarify.
And I don't want to leave a misimpression. While the presidents have been so great to host these luncheons, we paid for them. They didn't pay for them, so there's no commingling of funds.
Chair, yes. Just quickly, it seems like we have kind of an urgent imperative on this issue in the next couple of weeks. I'm just wondering if there's some sort of strategy that we could employ fairly soon to clarify maybe what our position is, not even knowing what that is. But, you know, could you explain what usually in the Board of Regents?
Yeah, let me just mention, yes, thank you, Regent Jones. In April, the presidents and I all signed a letter stating our support for this initiative. We are going to revise that now that we know what the ballot question is, and also to put President Tumina's and Interim President Tarbox on the letter, because the previous letter predated them, and then that can be shared.
One other thing, I want to thank Regent Larson. She has just done an ad for us that's going to all of the student body presidents are going to share with all of the students to help get them registered to vote and support this. So thanks very much.
I do think one of the things that any of us could do is they're looking for financial support because there's already, I mean, they have a campaign that I think Austin Cox is running, and they're ready to be effective communicators about what this is. And with the time left, I think that's going to be the most effective way we get the word out is through their campaign. But they need resources, and anything we can do, if it's not personally, it might be with others, might be with donors. I mean, the return on investment. This, you know, is pretty substantial if we get this done. So I would encourage that for anybody who can figure out how we might be able to help, and it needs to happen pretty quickly here in the next couple of weeks.
That's perfect.
I just questioned, is there any plan or idea could we work with Public Ed and with that letter and Public Ed support? Is there other editorials? Do we have any kind of public
I think that's a great idea. I know the governor has just come out with an ad that I think
Right, and it'll start next week. The governor has done an ad supporting it, and but I don't know if we could have an ad by the president. I don't. Would that be legal?
And I think we have actually we have a technical challenge in probably taking a position as a board because we didn't have this on the agenda, and so legally I don't think we can take action on it. Personally, I think the most effective thing we can do is to get the presidents. I mean that's who the public really resonate with, or their local institutions. So I hope we'll find opportunities to get this letter out, but I think we've got a challenge probably in getting our voice heard, short of having another meeting and noticing it up.
But, I might add, presence, yes, but students, very much so.
Yeah.
I think students tell the best story.
I totally agree.
Not only statewide.
Yes.
And individually, I know the campaign is really looking for social media, and they have some great links. So if you were to go there and spread the word, I know they're looking for that as well as the resources.
Well, again, great thanks to everybody who's been participating in on this, but especially Regent Anderson and Regent Marquardt. They've spent a lot of time and hard work, so thank you. Do we have Rich? Do you want to before we all? So. Oh, we have a handout. Take a look at this before tomorrow, if you will. This is from the University of Utah on the building. With that, make sure you get your forms to Rich. And I think we welcome a motion to adjourn. It's moved. The sheriff's by Regent Pryor, second by Regent Barnes. All in favor say aye.
Just mentioned to presidents, we're on at 7:30 tomorrow, or for, not presidents, for regents, we're on at 7:30 tomorrow morning for breakfast with the trustees.
No, I haven't
been here.